Well, good to see you all. And well, if you hadn't gathered already, I think we've had it reiterated to us quite a few times that we are in a series of living or wanting to see what it looks like to live the better, a better and best, our better and our best life, and how we can really flourish. And we're just kind of coming to the end of that, really, as we kind of go through the summer and looking at a few psalms as well in the context of that. And so if we want to really flourish, I feel that one of the best ways we can do that is to really be in touch with who we are made to be. So let's look at, in the context of what I'm entitling this talk to be, the essence of you or the essence of me, let's look at Psalm 139. I think that's going to come up on the screen. Have we got Psalm 139, Ali? Okay, let's just read this together. There are a few little sections that we're going to go to. And this is actually from the Passion Translation, which is particularly lovely. So let's just read this. For the pure and shining one, King David's poetic song. Lord, you know everything there is to know about me. You perceive every movement of my heart and soul. And you understand my every thought before it even enters my mind. You are so intimately aware of me, Lord. You read my heart like an open bookend. You know all the words I'm about to speak before I even start a sentence. You know every step I will take before my journey even begins. You've gone into my future to prepare the way, and in kindness you follow behind me to spare me from the harm of my past. With your hand of love upon my life, you impart a blessing to me. This is just too wonderful, deep and incomprehensible. Your understanding of me brings me wonder and strength. Where could I go from your spirit? Where could I run and hide from your face? And let's keep going. If I go up to heaven, you're there. If I go down to the realm of the dead, you're there. And if I fly with wings into the shining dawn, you're there. If I fly into the radiant sunset, you're there waiting. Wherever I go, your hand will guide me. Your strength will empower me. It's impossible to disappear from you, presence is everywhere, bringing light into my night. There is no such thing as darkness with you. The night to you is as bright as the day. There's no difference between the two. You formed my inmost being, shaping my delicate inside and my intricate outside, and wove them all together in my mother's womb. I thank you, God, for making me so mysteriously complex. Everything you do is marvelously breathtaking. It simply amazes me to think how thoroughly you know me, Lord. You even formed every bone in my body when you created me in the secret place, carefully, skillfully shaping me from nothing to something. You saw me, you created me to be before I became me, before I'd ever seen the light of day. The number of days you planned for me were already recorded in your book. And we'll go to the last section at the end. So if we could just go back to that first slide, Ali. So that's an amazing psalm, isn't it? Does that make you feel known? I love that psalm. A few of us were praying at the beginning of this week, and we were praying in a little group, and we ended up praying into the concept of the refining and the distilling, if you like, of the essence of, or rather the concept of the refining and the distilling of the essence of who we are as children of God. And I want to talk about that today and how to get in touch with the essence of who we are, who we were created to be in order that we could flourish as God's people. And really, as I said, I think that's what this psalm is all about. I wonder what it means, really, to be essentially you, for me to be essentially me. And I do realise that's a really big question. It's a bit of a philosophical one, really. Perhaps what I'm really looking at is knowing ourselves as God knows us, being in touch with that true part of ourselves, the potential in us, if you like. And one of the things that has happened in our culture, and some of you might know more about these than I do, is the growing interest in personality type testing or understanding of who we are. So perhaps the Myers-Briggs scale indicator or the Enneagram you might be familiar with. And really, these are tools to understanding ourselves better. So they're things like, are you more strongly introverted or extroverted? Do you need order in your life, high organisation, or do you like to wing it? Do you like to be original in the moment? And the point of that is not just that we know ourselves and how we work in our own right, but also how we interact with others, how we relate to other people, how I know myself in order that I could relate to you better. And of course, these things are not meant to limit us. Rather, they're meant to sort of bring freedom and help us to be more fruitful versions of who we are. So while some of these tests are very important and significant and helpful, and some of you may well have used them in your business or work scenarios, that's not what I'm talking about today particularly. And as I said earlier, we've been looking at what it means to really flourish recently. And of course, we've been looking at that in the context of biblical truths and from a biblical perspective. And one of the things I love about Jesus is that he said, he promised that I have come that you would have life, life in all its fullness. And wherever we are on that journey of faith, and we'll all be in different places today, I'm quite sure that that's what we want. We want a full life, don't we? And we want to live life to the best. So what does it mean to discover our true self in order that we can live the most fruitful life, I wonder? Well, some of us here are parents. We're all daughters and sons. Some have spouses, some of us have colleagues, work colleagues, we have friends, and we have all sorts of other significant people in our lives. But how well do we relate to them, I wonder? How self-aware are we? How much do we really understand and know and value in ourselves in order that we could live in good relationship, not only with ourselves, but with those other people around us? What we need to most know, apparently, as human beings, according to three very good psychologists, is that we are loved, secure, and significant. And I think we probably all agree with that. And I'm sure all of us here in this room this morning have homes, we have enough food, we have water. We know about our physical requirements, don't we? The amount of sleep that ideally suits us, what diet works for us best, how much exercise we theoretically should have, and so on. And paying attention to our physical needs is interesting in itself, isn't it? And some of us have perhaps pushed our bodies further than they should go. And maybe we've sort of wanted to beat the natural workings of our humanity. But we'll have a pretty good idea of how we best physically flourish and why we might feel grumpy after a week of not sleeping or, I don't know, too much wine the night before. But what about really knowing ourselves and why we think and behave in the way that we do? Almost the essence of us. Well, I'm going to suggest, I'm going to go through them quickly, or they're not very long, 10 ideas that may help us in our quest to know ourselves better. So let's start with, we are worth it. Let's have that slide up, Ali. So I want to say that we're all worth it. This is something you need to know about yourselves this morning. We all have intrinsic worth, value, and dignity as human beings. And do you know, that in itself calls for a deep personal respect for ourselves, doesn't it? An unconditional acceptance of who we are. And if you're anything like me, and I know other people who do this, it's easy to beat ourselves up for not being somebody else. It's easy to compare. Maybe we've always compared ourselves to a sibling or a friend. We so often, don't we, see things in others that we wish that we could be ourselves. Maybe we admire them in someone else, but we want to be like it too. How often do we go down that track, or we get thrown by what someone else seems to be able to hold together in their life that we just find we cannot hold in our own? Often we tell ourselves that we're rubbish. Maybe we feel a bit like that cat. So I wonder what it would look like for us to accept ourselves for who we are and to give ourselves that great gift of human worth. And by the way, this is a value that we might find in any humanistic philosophy, psychology, counselling theory and practice, as well as spiritual tradition. Second thought, we are all essentially positive. So I do believe, and I think we probably all believe in here, maybe we're on a journey to believing it, that we're made in the image of God. And therefore, our soul is fundamentally positive and trustworthy. So that's an interesting concept, isn't it? The concept of our soul. We sing about our soul. We sing about it very happily, but I wonder what we believe our soul is like. Well, I believe it's the part of us that is like our life centre, the part that correlates and integrates and enlivens everything that's going on within us, the various dimensions of myself. It's my soul that controls my inner world, as it were, the part that lies behind all that I present to you. And because it's the part that you can't see, and it's the part of you that I can't see, it actually means it's probably the part that we might neglect. Easy to neglect it. And in fact, it's probably the part that we need to pay best attention to. According to Dallas Willard, the soul was made by God, made for God, and made to need God. And many of us might think that we are bodies with a soul. Actually, as Willard says, we are in fact souls with a body. For me, that makes more sense. So in my mind, it must be good. We must be essentially positive. Let's move on to number three. We are all fundamentally or essentially spiritual beings. We've got number three, Ali. We're spiritual beings. And by that, I mean that we have an awareness of the something more to life. It's often the desire or the awareness to something that there is something more that actually leads people on a journey to finding God. Almost that sort of there's more to life. There's more. The further the further than the eye can see, the mystery part of life, if you like. And I believe that that's the part of us that connects with God. That's the part of our spirit that connects with God's spirit. The soul, my soul, needs God. Your soul needs God. John Ortberg, a well-known Christian writer, puts it like this: you are an unceasing spiritual being with an eternal destiny in God's great universe. I love that. The soul needs a future. God planted eternity in our souls so that we would not stop seeking life beyond ourselves. So we're made to do that. Let's move on to number four. And in all of us, there is a great need for growth and development. There is within all people potential, capacity, and need for growth and development. And this potential for growth is always there throughout our lifespan. So within all of us, there is this constructive or forward moving force. It's obvious, isn't it? From the time that we're babies, we're about development, aren't we? We're about development. We are living organisms, and living organisms grow and multiply. And that is what we are. As the psalm tells us that we've just read, Psalm 139, We are human beings, complex and wonderfully made. We are designed for change and progress, whether physically, emotionally, spiritually. And I think we can perhaps all identify with that sense of the reaching out for more. We are, as it were, biologically programmed not only for survival, but for continuous growth and maturation. And in psychology, you might call it the actualizing process. Or in more spiritual terms, you might call it the human spirit. And our human spirit is, as many of us will know, vulnerable. We are vulnerable to deeply painful and damaging life experiences. And our spirit can be quenched, though never totally destroyed, as a result of negative life and environmental things, environmental influences, things, if you like, that happened to us along the way. We looked at that last week, didn't we? We looked at the fact that in this world we would have trouble. We were promised it. Jesus promised that. He warned us. And this can lead to the blocking or the inhibiting or the distortion of our capacity to grow, for growth. And of course, this is as a consequence of the impact of the woundedness of, or the brokenness of others, and of the society in which we live. In other words, it's going to happen. We're broken, wounded people, and we are going to get hurt. We are complex, living unities of body, mind, soul, and spirit. And I believe that each affects the other. So we're sort of woven together, as it were. And if we believe that we, are, as human beings, have certain fundamental psychological and spiritual needs, needs such as the need to be loved, the need for self-esteem, the need to acquire knowledge, the need for significance, the great need to be understood, the need to make our own decisions, and even the need somewhere in the mix for beauty, and that we will develop our potential to the extent that these needs are met, then what happens when these go unmet or in some way are blocked? Well, in order to survive life, what we do is we create, and let's move on to the next slide, we create survival strategies. So we will all have adopted survival strategies along the way, won't we? In life, that's what we do. And thank God for survival strategies. They're not bad things in themselves. We're made to survive. And we will have learnt them in childhood. And they have helped us. And they're not bad in themselves. Let me give you an example. I grew up in a very busy household where my father was a vicar of a growing church. I was the eldest of five children, under seven, and I learnt that if I helped my mother, then life would be better for her, and the family would work, and I would survive, and we would all survive. And that was my survival technique. It meant for me tuning into my mother, my lovely mother, tuning into my mother's needs, her emotions. And if I was a good girl and I didn't sort of cause any trouble and I helped her where she needed help, life would be okay. I could survive in my family, which wasn't unloving, by the way. It was a very loving family, but it was a very, very full-on situation. Perhaps another member of my family would have adopted a different strategy. While I was being a good girl, maybe somebody else was being incredibly loud and attention-seeking, and gaining their attention and surviving in that way. People-pleasing or people-approval is a really common survival pattern. So too might be the need to perform. So we've all survived. We've all had very different backgrounds in this room, and we'll have all survived in different ways. I wonder what strategies you created for your survival. That's worth having a think about. So as we grow up, we learn how to survive. We learn how to find love and attention and knowledge and so on. And at the same time, what we're doing is we're actually creating a belief system, something I want to call a belief system. So let's move on to the next slide, a belief system. So my belief system might have looked something like this. I am responsible for how everyone around me feels. If they are not happy or content, it must be because of something I did or I didn't do. That was my belief system. Now, as you can imagine, over my lifetime, that's felt quite a heavy burden. That's actually quite a lot to carry. In fact, it's exhausting. I didn't consciously know that that was what I believed, but I have learned that this was what I was unconsciously holding. That was what I held as my particular belief system. So our experience of life and our combination of nature and nurture, as well as strategies for living that we have constructed, will have created for all of us in the room some kind of belief system. And I'm not necessarily talking about a religious or a faith belief system, although it may well include that. Rather, a system by which we make our life work. So if I'm kind to people around me, I can make the world a safe place for everyone. Or it may be for some, my experience of my father was that he was not safe. Therefore, all men are not safe. What we do is we take our belief with us into adult life, and somehow our childhood and our more up-to-date experience informs the way we see life. And we perhaps all know people in our lives who slightly mystify us, and we might think that they have real blind spots. Really, what we're seeing is the playing out of their belief system that they have created for themselves, which they support by life choices and their ways of being. Perhaps it's a way of understanding people. So I wonder what the messages were that you received when you were a child. For some of you, they may have been particularly significant in the way that you have gone on to do life. Definitely some of my personal journey has been orientated around acknowledging my strategies for living and a resulting belief system which has shaped the way that I have done life. And I've had to actually recognise that I can't be responsible for how everyone feels. Well, that's quite a relief, actually. I'm not responsible for how you all feel. So it's been an important part of my own self-understanding and awareness, and something that God has been really wanting to refine in me. Okay, let's look at number 7, knowing ourselves. We love to understand ourselves, don't we? What makes us react to things or people in a certain way? Why we repeat certain patterns of behaviour without being able to change? Well, I would be interested in that. I think it's why I went on to do counselling, actually. I'm interested. I don't know if it does particularly interest you. But for some of us here, that might mean that we have been in pretty difficult situations, perhaps because of some sort of default towards behaving in a repeat way that isn't good for us. I would want to know why. And often it's not until we hit a crisis that we do come face to face with ourselves, maybe an illness or a bereavement, or some sort of breakdown, or some sort of blow-up, that we begin to identify some of those areas that seem to have caused us in life so much trouble. Well, there's a story in John 4 about Jesus, and many of you will know this story well, but about Jesus meeting a woman at the well, where she has gone to get her water. It's midday, it's very hot. Very few would have gone to the well at midday at that time because of the heat, and that's exactly why she has chosen to go, because her reputation is not good, and so she is avoiding people. And she happens to bump into Jesus. And in short, they end up having a conversation where Jesus tells her that he knows all about her. He knows all about her life. And he tells her about her various relationships. He tells her things that he couldn't have known. And as she listens, she realizes that this man seems to really, really see her. And Jesus actually ends up and offering her a relationship with him, as he knows that she has come to the end of herself. And he says, as well as this drinking water which he offers her, there is another kind of water. There is a water that he would like to offer her, and it is the water of life. And she knows instinctively that it's good. She knows that it's what she's been needing, because she knows it's about being known and really understood. And she actually runs off to the village, and she says to all her friends, or the people in the village, come and meet a man who told me everything I ever did. And that is so powerful, isn't it? I find that so powerful. God totally gets us. I really feel that that's a story, not only about being offered relationship with Jesus, but it's a story about being known. He totally understands us. When we don't understand ourselves, and he can bring revelation to me and to you about who we are, the essence of us, as it were. And I believe that that's what's so great about God. One of the things I found so interesting in my Christian experience is how God meets us so uniquely to our individual personal need. And this particular woman, her desire was to be known, to be truly known by someone, a man, in a way that she had never experienced. She had experienced men in other ways, but she hadn't felt known. And this was her need. This was her specific need. And Jesus knew that, and he met her. He met her need that day. Knowing God in this way, as in feeling really understood, is a little like perhaps when you first fall in love and you just feel known and you feel fully you. And it's because ultimately this is where our identity is. We are made in God's image, and so we are known and we're understood by him. Let's move on to number 8. Changing our behaviour. Well, it's one thing to know ourselves, isn't it? It's one thing to get a bit of a grasp on, well, you know, okay, this is who you're telling me I am, God. But it's another thing to be able to change our behaviour. And so once we have a bit of a handle on where these ways of being, as it were, maybe come from, for example, why certain situations maybe make us feel really anxious, or why we realise that we're living constantly apologetically as if we don't think we should be here, or whatever it is that for us we're aware is hindering our life, we then have the challenge of changing our behaviour, don't we? And behaviour management is a very, very big area. But to simplify it, it's really about being in control of our responses. And there are lots of figures out there that suggest it doesn't come easy. If we're used to responding to or reacting to those around us in certain ways, then a change of behaviour may take a long, long time. Apparently, it takes 21 days to form a new habit. I've heard so many figures on that one. But re-establishing patterns has to come out of a conviction of a need to change. And I think it's often our conviction that takes us on that journey. And Jesus, during his life on earth, was an absolute master, wasn't he, at putting his finger on what was needed in order to refine the inward and outward way of being of the people that he came across. So whether it was the heart of the rich young ruler, where perhaps his wealth had become part of his identity and his method of control, his strategy perhaps, or perhaps he'd gained his sense of worth through, perhaps where he had gained his sense of identity and worth, or perhaps the prostitute who had gained her sense of worth through the availability of her body, or the man at the pool of Bethsaida. who Jesus asked if he really, really, do you really want to get well? Jesus knew he challenged deeply the behavior and the strategies of these people. And there are so many examples, aren't there? What about Martha and all her busyness? I mean, I wonder what that was all about. So Jesus challenges us too, doesn't he? And he challenges us so gently. What is the essence of you and me? If you like, the true you, your true self, my true self, that he is wanting to get to the heart of and gently bring his touch to. And so if so much of our behaviour is to do with protecting that part of us, whether consciously or subconsciously, that Jesus knows about and wants to call out and refine by his Spirit, we need to break the cycle, don't we? So how do we do that? So that's number 9, breaking the cycle. Thanks, Ali. Well, as I said, by admitting that there's an issue, by coming face to face with it, by sharing the issue with someone, by looking further into what lies behind our behaviour or our thinking, by offering ourselves some self-kindness. No wonder. Holding ourselves accountable to someone we trust, praying and asking God for help. Mark and I recently went to see Rocket Man, the Elton John film. How many of you have seen that film here? Anybody? Ooh. I would recommend it, but don't watch 5 minutes of it. We found it totally fascinating. It was a very good study, actually, of much of what I'm talking about, to be honest. And at one point in the film, Elton is depicted as... let's find my paper here. He's depicted as going into, as coming into the end of a certain point of his life, where he just can't go on, and he checks himself into a clinic. And in the context of this clinic, he gradually comes to terms with the reality of how the little boy, little Elton, who actually was known as Reggie, has been so responsible for so much of his behaviour. His adult pain and his sense of isolation and his resulting behaviour, where his close relationships actually have been so deeply damaged. And he realises the significance and the resulting life strategy that his particular belief system has, that he has been working with in order to survive. So for him, in knowing about the little boy, and his little boy experience and understanding his adult life experience is his great his key, really, to a greater stability in life. In order to do relationships better, he had to know his true self. So for all Elton's giftedness and flamboyance and whatever you think about him, you have to admit that he's gifted, and success, there was a huge shadow cast as well. And it's so often the shadow side of a great strength that can cause so much trouble for us in life. And we don't have to be a pop star, do we, to experience that? Understanding and making friends with that part of us, the part that can cause trouble, is so important. I wonder what your shadow might be. Mine could look like perfectionism or control. And I've really needed to know about that part of me in order to manage my life better, not just for my own sake, but for the sake of people around me, for the sake of my relationships. And it is the place that we act from or act out of that God wants to bring his refining touch to. Ultimately, it is his love that we need. In fact, for me, giving myself some self-love in the knowledge that I am thoroughly loved, thoroughly and unconditionally loved by God, and seeing myself as he sees me, is increasingly becoming my new life strategy. And finally, let's look at number 10, my last thought, loving myself in order to be able to love you. In the end, we can only really give away what we have received and what we have allowed God to do for us. So understanding or knowing ourselves and being in touch with our true selves and allowing God's touch on us is, in essence, to show ourselves love. Jesus loved us first in order that we could know what love is and then that we could love ourselves. In understanding and offering ourselves love, we can ultimately relate better to the people around us and actually become a blessing. We want to be a blessing to each other, don't we? Even the second commandment recognizes that. Love others as you love yourself. We can't really love others if we're not loving ourselves. Back to that prayer meeting last week I mentioned at the beginning. I found myself thinking further about the concept of the essential oils that have been distilled down into their true, authentic essence. These oils, in their unique identity, stripped of all other additives and complexity, actually hold in themselves the most incredible healing, aromatic quality. If you like, they are alive fully in their true essence. This reminds me of the story, another story, which I think we've got on the screen actually, of the woman who anointed Jesus' feet with the purest of perfume. I love this story so much. I'm just going to read it to us. 6 days before the Passover began, Jesus went back to Bethany, the town where he had raised Lazarus from the dead. They had prepared a supper for Jesus. Martha served, and Lazarus and Mary were among those at the table. Mary picked up an alabaster jar filled with nearly a liter of extremely rare and costly perfume, the purest extract of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet. Then she wiped them dry with her long hair, and the fragrance of the costly oil filled the house. But Judas, the locksmith, Simon's son, the betrayer, spoke up and said, "What a waste. We could have sold this perfume for a fortune and given the money to the poor." In fact, Judas had no heart for the poor. He only said this because he was a thief and in charge of the money. He would steal money whenever he wanted to from the funds given to support Jesus' ministry. Jesus said to Judas, "Leave her alone. She has saved it for the time of my burial. You will always have the poor with you, but you won't always have me." And I just love that story. I love it. It often makes me want to cry. But what I love about it most is the authenticity of her offering, the extravagance of it, criticized by the onlookers, and the huge risk that it took this woman to be real and thoroughly exposed. This woman, and it could have been a man, but somehow in that culture, perhaps it was more significant that it was a woman. She'd been so brought to life by Jesus, so realized, if you like, by him. She could only offer him what was essential to her, if you like. What was most beautiful and most reflective of her true self. And it was sacrificial, truly sacrificial. And it was expensive. It was really expensive and it was costly. And somehow Jesus had got to the heart of this woman, hadn't he? He'd got, in one sense, the true essence of her. And I really believe that's what God wants to do for us. He is calling out of us our true self, that part that we might have most closely defended and cleverly managed in order that we may be refined and purified and made even more beautiful by him. More beautiful, more aromatic. And it may feel really risky and it may feel costly and exposing. but he loves it. I really believe it's the part of us he most loves. It's the us that he loves. He loves it, and it is life in all its fullness. And it is about knowing what is within us, that we are unconditionally loved and known, uniquely us, essentially us. And, you know, God will use anything to get us there. He actually wastes nothing. And for some people, I really believe, actually, that he meets them. And this is not a new thought. I know that you know this. But I really believe that he meets many people on their deathbeds. And all becomes clear. And all is revealed. And for others of us, we have this opportunity, don't we, to do this journey along the way. And yes, God does use personal crisis, and he does use illness, and he does use glorious moments to do his work. And so much of my personal journey has been in this arena. I have known that sense of painful refining and coming to face to face with my true self and that part of me that God has really needed to do deep business with. And he does it in love, I can tell you. Because he is pure love. He is pure love. And he can't be anything else. And it is his purity that transforms us into the fullness of who he calls us to be. The fully us. And so how much better our relationship with ourselves, our marriages, our friendships, our relationships and our children would be if we just let God. The more we are aware of who he has made us to be, in other words, what our true essence is, the more we can be a blessing to those around us. I just want to finish with a quote, a prayer really, by a woman called Jill Rowe. I just love this. May you never forget that you can make this world a more glorious place to live in for everyone, simply by loving others as yourself. And may you always know the voice of God calling you by name and in all that life is for you. So that is my prayer for us all. I wonder if we could just stand. Shall we stand? And there's a song that, an old song that many of you might remember, and I love. And I did ask Attell if we could sing it. And I just wonder if maybe if we could just put our hands on our hearts. I feel like we've been talking about that deep place within us. That's our soul. And our soul is, let's let our hearts be the representative of our soul, maybe. And Lord, as we sing this song, this is about you purifying us and enabling us to be all that you have planned for us to be.